Torah, sometimes I want to teach you how to be a good demagogue. So tonight's how to be a good demagogue. I don't want to be a good demagogue, pay attention carefully. And I've hidden an agenda about teaching you how to be a good demagogue.
Okay.
So I met a good demagogue. I met him a long time ago. He actually wiped the floor with me, let's put it that way. Demagogues, they don't really speak substance. They just speak slogans. They just shout out loud exaggerations, escalations. There's really no substance to them, but they have a way of riling people up and getting them on their side and fomenting and inciting. And so let me tell you about the demagogue I once met and was roundly, roundly vanquished by. When I went to Yeshiva University when I was your age, I decided I was going to do three things and only three things. Eat, learn, and get my degree. Sleep was out of the question. Eat, learn Torah, and get my degree. I don't have politics and campus life, and it's just, you know, one big mirage. I really wanted to focus on eternal values. I wanted to use that time to grow as a person. So I kept my head under the radar, wasn't involved in much. Eating, learning, getting my degree. Until one day, some Israel club in Yeshiva University invited a very interesting speaker to come speak to the entire Yeshiva University campus. His name was Meir Kahane. So the whole base matters emptied out, including me. All of us, the current roster of Rosh Yeshivas and YU, are my friends. We didn't spend a minute out of the base matters of all of our years in YU. We decided we're going to protest. Why do we want to protest? We went into the politics so much, but he had said some really, really nasty things about Rabbi Soloveitchik, and some really pugnacious things about Rav Lichtenstein, and some really, really aggressive things about other Rabbanim, and we felt Kavanat Torah, we have to leave the Beis Medrash in protest. His basic spiel was that all these rabbis who have American and Western influences are tainting the true Judaism, which is much more racist than bigoted than, you know, they're willing to allow. So when people say you shouldn't be killing Arabs, or you should be respecting their rights, those are just Western influence. If you take a look at the true Torah, say for Yeshua, that's the true Torah we should enact. That was the basic, which you could discuss. I think it's a fairly silly conversation, but it wasn't being discussed in a substantive way. It was being discussed in a way that these rabbis were. Anyway, one of the most famous lines, he called Rabbi Soloveitchik a Hellenist. That was his way of describing Western influences corrupting the true, authentic Torah. Anyway, he said really nasty things. So he had all these yeshiva bachurim coming out to protest. It was one of the lamest protests you could ever imagine. And there's one thing yeshiva bachurim don't know how to do, and I proved it, it's protest. He had these little signs that were like, Brisker Chakiras, my Hellenist. Not the way you protest, like rhetorical questions. It didn't work. So we didn't just protest, but we also decided we're going to heckle him during the lecture. Not heckle, like we're not good hecklers, but like we're going to pepper him with questions during the entire lecture. So I was delegated to be one of the question pepperers. So I peppered him with a question, and I said, I have a question, in the middle of a speech, I have a question. Guys, you don't ask a demagogue a question. Asking a demagogue a question is like putting your neck out and handing him a knife. It's a slaughter, it was a massacre. So I have a question. I said, what's your name? And this little kid shaking in the audience. And he had brought all of his followers, and demagogues like to bring built-in followers so that they're ready clapping anytime you sneeze. So he brought 30 of his ardent followers every time he grimaced, clapping, and giving him a real yashkoyach. And I said, I have a question for you. What's your name? Moshe. What's your question? I said, well, you say you're a Rosh Yeshiva, because that was his bit, you're a Rebbe, and yet you go around from yeshiva to yeshiva, and all you talk about is killing people. You ever give us a shiur on Migo? You ever give us a shiur on Beitza, whatever? I listed five or six topics. You do not want to ask a demagogue a question. He said, what's your name? Moshe, you come to my yeshiva tomorrow, and I'll teach you all those topics. When he clearly couldn't. Everyone started talking. And time and time, you just destroyed us. He wasn't saying anything. He couldn't teach us those topics. It was just phrases, popular phrases, slogans, just to rile people up. So you got to know how to deal with it. There's actually one person who is a very, very controversial rabbi today. I'm not going to say his name. He actually got him. He actually knew how to do it, but that's for another time. Because he denied everything we were saying he denied. So someone got up and said, I will wager you $10,000 that you called Rabbi Soloveitchik the following terrible things in the Jewish press of the following year on the following line, like, you don't give him any room to move. You say, this is what you did, yes or no. Demagogues need yes or no challenges. Anyway, the point is not history of demagoguery. The point is how to tell a demagogue and why it's important. This isn't a lesson on how to discern demagoguery. This is a lesson on how to be a better person. And I hope that by learning about demagoguery, you'll be able to understand how to be a better person and not just how to avoid being a demagogue. So let's study Korach. Korach is the classic demagogue. Okay, and I'll tell you his demagoguery, and you'll see it in a moment. But before we discuss his demagoguery, I have to warn you. Okay? Any hypersensitive kids out there, you know, you cry easily, you know, you go to movies and every 2 seconds you're crying. If you do, get a lot of tissues, okay? Because it's going to be a real tearjerker, okay? Any of you out there a little bit, you know, ballerinas, you can't hold back your emotions, okay? Get ready, we're going to need you to get your tissues ready, because this is only for the robust of heart. Here's the story that Korach told, and it's going to be really, really sad. So I'm just warning you, any of you guys, petunias out there, don't tell me I didn't warn you. If you go out crying, don't blame me, okay? Don't say, oh, you made me cry. I'm not going to take any of that stuff from you, okay? Here's the story. Korach gathers the entire nation. We all know the famous story, the Tchela story, the Mezuzah story. That's not the story I'm going to tell you. Here's Korach's story. He stands up in front of a throng of people, and he tells the following tearjerker. And I will tell you because I know it. Here's the story. Source number base. We'll see what he's called later. Let's get into the story. Hischilom lefnim divrei litzanus. The word litzanus means two things. Right now we'll interpret it as demagoguery. Soon we'll interpret it as something a little less than demagoguery, but on a demagoguery scale. I'm not going to tell you what that mystery word is, but you'll find out what that mystery word is after we hear the story. Amana achas haya, line 3, a poor widow. Okay, I'm already starting to feel my emotions well up inside. She lost her husband, it's hard for her, she goes to shul, no one to make kiddush, no one to make havdalos, this is a tough luck situation. Mishchunasi, she lived in my neighborhood, and she had two darling orphan children. One was cuter than the next. Rosy cheeks, pigtails, braces, and these are two of the cutest girls you could ever set your eyes on. And all she wanted to do was to raise her two little daughters. You know what? She wasn't just a widow. She was pretty poor. And she wasn't, she didn't get divorced from some rich tycoon or something with a $35 billion settlement. She was poor. She got one little field, just trying to get by, earn a living, make some money, raise her family. Honest living. Baslachosh. So she goes out one day, she starts to plow. How are you going to support a family if you can't plow? Who shows up? Handlebar mustache Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu with a handlebar mustache, all oily and grimy. You want to plow? Oh, yeah, let me tell you. You're not plowing so fast, lady. Lady's a word you should never use because it's disrespectful. I'm just using it because that's how Korach is making Moshe speak. Hey, lady, you should be plowing because you got a whole bunch of Yisrael I got in store for you. You can't plow with an oxen, with a camel, and with a cattle together, with oxen, with a donkey. So don't just think you can plow. Look at me, guys. I'm watching you. I got eyes on you. Don't think you're going to make a living so quickly. You're not plowing with donkeys and cows together. Okay. She's an obedient woman. Can't really fight Moshe fighting city halls. Okay. I'm cool with that. She plows as Moshe, handlebar mustache, diabolical Moshe, barked at her. Now it's time to plant. Very humble, she takes her seeds, starts scattering. What do you think walks into the room? Moshe Rabbeinu, pistols firing. Swashbuckling Moshe says, oh, I got you again. Don't just think you can sow your field the way you want to, okay? I got you, okay? I'm watching. No kilayim, be careful, plow it the right way, sow it the right way. Okay, pretty obedient, pretty compliant. Now it's time to harvest. Now it's really dramatic now because if she doesn't harvest, she's going to go starving for the entire winter. I mean, this is really high drama. Bas Liktzar Lasa Sarema. Now she comes with this big scroll. Let's see. Like it. Shechacha. Pea. Don't take everything out of the field. You have to leave some for the Aniyim. And there are three now. That's just one answer. I got three eyes on you. You got one eye for Leket, one eye for Shechacha, and my other eye for Pea. So you're not making, so this poor woman, can plow, she has to overpay for her plowing, because it would be easier to plow with a donkey and an ox. And she's got to overpay for her seeds, can't just throw it randomly. She's got to overpay and now suffer a loss because she's got to leave legged shechil peah in the field. She says, okay, I got my modest little grain. I'll do my best with my two little daughters. One of them needs braces. One of them has that milk money, but I'll do my best to help them out. And she brings it all into the house and she makes what's called a goren, where all the grain is assembled. And now, bus lasas goren, line number 6. I'm going to let Tini. No please here. Notice the no please. Tini, Moshe slams his fist on the table. Truma, Mesa Rishon, Mesa Shani. I'm not finished with you yet. You think I'm finished with you? I got a long list of demands. You're not going anywhere. You're not feeding your kids. You're feeding. And of course, now Moshe's pretty fat. He's got a nice beer belly, not just a handlebar mustache. You're feeding the fat cats before you can make a little money for your little poor orphans. Okay, this is a good woman. You see how the story is landing? This woman says, okay, it's Dika Lesedin Ma'asa, line number 7. She says, you know what? I can't deal with this Moshe. I'm going to be planting, he's going to be screaming. I'm going to be harvesting, he's going to be grabbing, sticking his grimy fingers. You know, I'm going to get away from this whole Moshe, this whole state taxation. I'm going to invest my money in animals. It's not going to be as financially remunerative, but at least have a good meal. You know, I'm going to die from poverty, but at least I'll have a couple good meals on the way to my grave, because animals don't really make more money, but at least I'll have a couple lamb chops for my final dinner. So she sells her little land, and she buys 2 little lambs. Oh, how cute. 2 cute little lambs. Everyone likes a lamb. They're all furry and woolly, and they look so cute. So you get these 2 little lambs and 2 little girls. And now it's winter, and she has no food. But at least she can shear the wool and make knit a sweater. Right? Who doesn't like an old woman sitting on the doorstep knitting a sweater? Everyone likes a sweater. Everyone likes an old bubby making a sweater. Who doesn't like that scene? So she sells the land, she's got 2 sheep, she's making a sweater, and who do you think comes by? Not Moshe, because, you know, Moshe's taking a break from this abuse. His sidekick, Aaron. Aaron comes in, he says, wait a second. Okay, you got 2 land, you got 2 sheep? I got dibs on the Bechor. Whatever animals are going to be born from these 2 sheep is all mine, that big mine. And not only that, you're going to share? Gracious, I guess. Give me the first part of your sharing. Tzinias HaBacharos. Time for share. Give me the Gziza. 4 lines in the bottom. He says, you know, I can't take this. First it's Moshe. Now it's Aaron. All of this religion is one big system of abuse. You know what religion is? It's just meant to abuse poor widows and their orphan children. That's how I see Torah. That's what Torah is, Korach is trying to sell to the people. You're following this Torah of Moshe, these laws of Moshe Rabbeinu, it's abusive, it's manipulative, it's exploitative. They're taking it from women, they're taking it from orphans, they're taking it from widows. So she decides, I can't make money with my field, I can't make money by raising sheep, I'll just slaughter the animal, have my meal, and go down at least with a full stomach, a full belly. So she shechs them, kivan sheshachta, Aaron's sitting right there and saying, okay, hand it over, zroa, hand me over the flank, Lechayayin, give me the cheek. The cheek is really juicy meat. If you ever had cheek meat, it's really juicy. Vekeva, give me the part of the intestines. Amra, she says, Afilo acha sheshachati otam lo nitzalti miyado. I can't get away from these rapists. I can't get away from these thieves. I can't get away from these criminals. She says, you know what? I don't care. At least let me get a mitzvah. I'm going to take whatever little I have. I started out, I was married, I had a husband, I had a living, I had a profession. Now here I am. My 2 kids are dying. They're starving to death. I'm the modern day Naomi. I tried my best. These abusers took it all away from me. You know, at least I'll get a mitzvah. I'll give it to tzedakah. She says, Harei Aleichem. I went to go, and Aaron says, welcome to my world. Now it's all mine. Now you made it all mine. Haven't you seen the movie? Bank dispossesses, kicks him out of the land. Now you're out homeless. No food, no clothing, no land, nothing. It's all mine. Korach says, this is what you're buying into. Abuse, immorality, exploitation. And he foments the crowd, whips them into a frenzy. He starts screaming at Moshe. Moshe, Aaron, you criminals, you devils. Oh, you spend your time ruining the lives of orphans. manipulating widows, exploiting them. And everyone's screaming. And no one's thinking. That's what demagogues do well. Guys, this is what Torah is about. Exploitation and manipulation. This is what the gifts for Kohanim and Levim are about. Fattening fat cats. The Torah envisions a world in which there's an elite group of people who have to operate in the Beis HaMikdash, and that requires very, very, very stiff, lifestyle changes, especially if you're a Kohen. And they're not just lifestyle changes that deal with vigilance. They are lifestyle changes in which essentially you are subjecting yourself to a life of poverty. If you don't own land, and Kohanim don't own land, and Levim own land, but it's a little bit weakish. They own some Ari Miklat, they can't really build. You own land, but you're basically reclamation clinics for people who have murdered. You can't build, you can't develop, you can't sell. You're basically living hand to mouth, going around collecting charity. You could agree or disagree with Haredi lifestyles. But one thing is true. You should stand in awe of people who voluntarily subject themselves to a life of poverty for the sake of Torah. And even if you feel that that formula is not the formula you prefer, are you willing to make similar sacrifices in your life? Heck, are you willing to make any sacrifices in your life? Will there be a time where you'll have to choose where to live, which university to attend, whether to move to Israel, and will it always be about the money? Or are you willing to say, you know what, I'll make a choice based on ideals and values, even if it's a little less money? Will you have that courage? Will you have that fortitude? That's what Cohen's life's about. It's about widows and orphans. It's about normal people who have, Baruch Hashem, plenty, who have many fields, many family members, many animals, and some of the halacha's not even about Kohanim. The halacha of an ox and a donkey not plowing together has nothing to do with the Kohanim, nothing to do with Moshe. It's about a Kodesh Baruch Hu establishing differences in this world. And as much as we want to creatively advance Hashem's world, there's certain boundaries Hashem expects us not to cross. No hybridization between donkeys and between oxen. No contact. It's about a Kodesh Baruch Hu's world, a Kodesh Baruch Hu's boundary. Maybe we'll talk about this a little bit later. Now, is there a scenario, guys? Is there a scenario, if you put two and 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 two together, is there a scenario where this whole system could be manipulative to widows? Of course there is. What will happen in that scenario? We'll step in. The coin won't take it from that widow. The coin will take it and give it back as a gift. We'll give the widow some charity money. Obviously, here's the key line. Every system, every law, every person, every value has its flaws when it fails in real time. But just because there's a flaw doesn't mean that the whole system is corrupt. It just means there's a flaw we have to find a workaround and an end around. But that's what a demagogue does. A demagogue, in order to upend and deride the system, finds the one flaw, amplifies it, exaggerates it, tells a story, makes it as if it's characteristic, and then encourages the people, this is bunk. This is all just garbage. This is all just rejected. Let's look at this story. Rather than sitting calmly and saying, look, this is one story out of 10,000, and in this case, we'll intervene and find a way for it to survive. That's being a good demagogue. The other stories that you know about are also demagoguing, but they're not as glaring. Where Korach comes and says, well, if one string of tchelos suffices, what about a cloth that's all tchelos? It's the same thing. It's counterlogical, Korach is saying. How can it make sense? The system must be illogical, must be irrational. If one string of tchelos is enough, why not an entire begging? And anyone who's learned 5 minutes of menachos and 5 minutes of hochasitzes can calmly tell you there's a difference between the garment and between the strings. They have different functions. The garment has this function, the strings has another function. Without getting knee-deep into tzitzis right now, the tchelos on the strings has one symbol. The tchelos on the garment is a totally irrelevant, unrelated. And then Karl says, what about a house that has plenty of Sifrei Torah and it doesn't need a mezuzah on the doorpost? And again, in a flash and in a moment, if you shout it out in front of a mob of thousands of people, it seems crazy. 5 minutes of learning Hilchos Bezuzah. 5 minutes, just think about it, you got the answer. Hashem wants a mini Sefer Torah placed on the doorpost, on the gateway, for a thousand different reasons. Gateways, transitions, protections, home, icons. And you won't have that if you have 15 Sefer Torah in your bedroom or 15 Sefer Torah in your dining room. So get past it. Stop speaking nonsense. Talk to me. Talk logic. Talk substance. Stop trying to manipulate me. Stop trying to manipulate the facts. I can see through you. It's not true. You're making up facts. And I'm going to call you on it. You want to talk to me? Talk substantively to me. Train yourselves not to be victimized by demagogues. And learn the tools of demagoguery. Exaggeration. Escalating, absurd, making things absurd, saying things just to pull at your heartstrings in an excessive manner, excessive emotional manipulation. Learn the differences so you can meet real people with real ideas and judge them by their ideas. But that's not my purpose here. I'm not trying to guard you against demagoguery. Because there is a stepsister to demagoguery that you all have to work on, and we all have to work on. You know what the stepsister of demagoguery is? If you look at the Medrash quotes the first pasuk in Tehillim, and it associates that word with Korach, because Korach was that person, but on steroids, advanced, a demagogue. You know what a mini demagogue is called? A letz. You know what a letz is? Someone who's cynical. A demagogue is merely someone who's very, very cynical. What does a demagogue share with cynicism? It's the same DNA. People who are cynical, how are you cynical? The following way. Person comes, you see an idea, you see a person, you see an organization, you see something that most people say, wow, that's great. That's fantastic. Let me celebrate it. I'm enthused by it. I'm excited by it. A cynic says, well, let me find the flaw. And if I can find the flaw, then the whole system must be ridiculous. That's what cynicism is. Cynicism is the ability to find the flaw, the bad trait in the person, the bad expression of this trait. Well, if you're this, then you can become this. Of course you can, if you don't moderate it. And who do you think are the best cynics? You know what makes the best cynic? The smartest person. The best analyst. Because they're always able to see 15 different sides. And you're always able to find the flaw, the limitation, the problem with an idea, an organization, a person. There was a study conducted about 15 years ago. They're starting to map certain character traits to parts of the brain. And they found the part of the brain that leads to cynicism and sarcasm. For the moment, let's assume they're the same. That part of the brain was unusually large in smart people. Oh, that's a shocker. I mean, smart people have a greater predilection to be cynical. Because the smarter you are, the more you can analyze, the more sides you can see, the easier it is for you to shield yourself from something fantastic and potentially inspiring and just saying, nah. You know the modern day Korachs are? Not just the demagogues. Those are easy to see. By the way, Trump was a great demagogue. I mean, he was a world-class demagogue. If you're going to give a course on demagogue where you can just like follow his speeches one after another, it was just transparent. It was brilliant, but it was transparent. Like, there's no facts. There's no content. I'm not saying whether you would support a supportive member, as I've told you before, those who are here. You can agree with all of his views and all of his opinions and all of his policies, but just the mannerism of the demagogue. And maybe he's not the biggest Trump supporter, but just the tools that he used with demagogue. He was, look, maybe some people just don't like those tools and those methodologies. But he's a great demagogue. You know what the modern demagogues are? They're not as extreme as the demagogues. You know what they're called? They're called comedians. And I have very, very, very low tolerance for comedians. Like, I've got a group of people I don't have tolerance for, and they're on the top of that list. Because most of them, it's all it is. They're too smart for their own good. They can analyze anything and inflate it to an extreme. By the way, don't get me wrong. There are certain comedians I love listening to. My wife and I from time to time listen. But not when they're cynical. When they're self-effacing. When they're about themselves. And even if they're making fun of other people, it depends upon the body. You can tell the difference. You can tell the difference between biting, cynicism, rejectionism, derision, or just good old fun, or make fun of you, make fun of... Here's a good rule today. Okay, if you want to, if you have a good sense of humor in life, and some of you have a good sense of humor, first of all, don't give it up because it's really, really useful. Breaks tension, tell a good joke, it's really good. But you have to, it has to be balanced between giving and taking. Half of your joke should be about yourself, half of your joke should be about others. And then basically you just, everyone knows you're not trying to be cynical, you're just trying to be funny. And you're being funny about yourself. There's a really, really, really thin line between funny and comedic and humorous and cynicism. And if you listen carefully to comedians, you could tell the difference in 5 minutes. Take all Texas, you know where they are within 5 minutes. And I strongly, strongly recommend not listening to the cynical ones. Because it seeps in. It really, really seeps in. By the way, I strongly recommend the same with consuming popular media. When people watch movies or people watch television series, the only thing they ask themselves, which are important questions, are how many curse words there are and how much sexuality there is. And they don't often enough ask, well, what are the values underwriting this? And more importantly, how are those values being conveyed? Because you may not be paying attention, but there's a lot of value seepage, a lot of cultural creep. And you just want to make sure, I would even say, look, I don't want to tell you what to watch, what not to watch. And maybe even better, as a Ben Torah, not you should watch too much any of these, to watch a program with bad words, because these words just roll off of your mind, rather than programs or movies with clean words, but with really, really rotting values or rotting personal profiles that you are encouraged to agree with and to identify with and associate with. Because they start to seep into your character. You become those people. So that's why Karach is called source number days of Moshe of Leitzim Loyash Zekarach. Moshe Leitzim Loyash Zekarach. Karach is a Leitz. A Leitz cube. The Leitz times two is a demagogue. I hope no one in this room will ever be a demagogue. If you do, please don't mention you learned in my shir. It's like Yaakov Avinu. Please don't put my name down. On your demagogue resume, when you apply for the demagogue job, just don't say you learned in the Gush. Say you learned somewhere else. I don't think anyone here is going to be a professional demagogue. But I want you to know the difference between demagogues and real people. But more importantly, because this is about you, not about your ability to know the difference between helpful and toxic people, just to be careful, because there's a little trace of demagoguery and cynicism. And if there's one trait, I strongly, strongly, strongly encourage you to nip in the bud before it takes hold, it's cynicism and sarcasm. It's really important to work on that when you're young, especially if you're bright, especially if you have a sense of humor, especially if you're a good analyst and you know how to analyze things. It is so corrosive. Like with every bad trait, the punishment for a bad trait is a bad trait. Hashem doesn't have to punish you for bad traits. Hashem punishes you for bad actions. Hashem doesn't punish you for bad traits. Lav shame bo maisa. Because if you have that trait, it will poison you. If you're jealous, Hashem doesn't have to punish you for being jealous. You know what your punishment is? You'll spend your whole life being jealous. And that's a terrible way to lead your life. If you're angry, Hashem doesn't have to punish you for being angry. You know what your punishment is? You'll spend your whole life in a fit of rage. And it's not a way to lead your life. And if you're cynical, Hashem doesn't have to punish you. You're just going to be cynical. You'll be bitter and negating. And slowly the circle of people that you're willing to not be cynical about will shrink as you rejected this one, negated that one, cynical about that one, sarcastic about this one. At a certain point, you're out of targets. You shot so many bullets of cynicism, there's no one left in your life. And you know the last person standing to be cynical about, it's called you. And when you start to be cynical about yourself, then you enter a territory that's really, really hard to leave. And that's called pessimism. And the deep part of that territory is called depression. If you're optimistic about yourself and confident in yourself, then you're a good life and you see people. Once you start down that road to cynicism, the final stops on that train are pessimism and depression. And you're more bitter. Pessimism, bitterness, and depression. You're going to be someone that believes in this world, believes in people, believes in yourself, believe in people, or believe in yourself. So that's a real takeaway from Karach. Don't be a mini Karach. Don't be a major Karach. Don't be a mini Karach either. Try to avoid that. Okay, what else do we have tonight? Okay, what time is it? Careful with your words. Careful with your words. Even when you're talking to someone who deserves, be very careful with the words you use. talked a little bit before about escalation, communication. I spoke about that this morning. Okay, there's a great book written, a very popular modern book called Nonviolent Communication. How to communicate in a way that doesn't make people feel victimized or predated upon. Different ways of violent communication. Cursing is obviously violent communication. Shouting is violent communication. Dishonest, passive aggressive, where you say one thing, you mean another thing. It's violent communication. Taunting, violent communication. Imitating someone, right? When you imitate them and you talk like they're talking, just violent communication. You want to keep your communication as substantive as possible, even keel. You don't raise your voice, you're not manipulative. You just say, this is what I feel. If you feel differently, easier said than done. It's easy for me to say it to you, it's hard for me to say it to people in my life. Easy for you to hear it, hard for you to implement it. But start thinking in those terms. So one of the forms of violent communication, as I said before, is taunting or choosing words because they'll be hurtful, rather than because they'll be as clear as possible. You want to be as clear as possible. You want to think about your words carefully. That's why a lot of times when you're young and you have a hard conversation with someone, it pays to write it out first, or it pays to send them an email, because it's hard for you to choose the right words when you're angry. As you get a little older, you get calmer, you don't let anger overcome you, and it's easier for you to think about the words you're going to say. Think about the words. It's always really important. You think it's silly, but word choice is absolutely crucial. And words you use can make, words kill. And words can make a ton of difference in this world. So, Moshe Rabbeinu, source number Dalet, part 2, tells the Levim, the 250 Levim, it's not clear whether the Levim were Bechoros, he says, Rav Lachem B'nei Levi, you have enough. It seems like a very innocent statement until you read it in context. Who had said the word Rav Lachem before? Well, the cheat sheet. Korach had accused Moshe Rabbeinu. Source number Dalet, part 1, Vayikalu al Moshe v'yal Aron v'yimor lehem Rav Lachem. You have too much, Moshe. You have enough. You have too much power. They were claiming. And a few hours later, when Moshe comes back at them and says, Rav Lachem B'nei Levi, you know, Moshe didn't say anything terrible. He didn't curse, Chas V'Shalom. He wasn't angry at this stage. But looking back, you can see where it's a little bit taunting, right? You can see where you came and said, we have too much, and right back at you. I'm throwing it back in your face. Like, pick another word. There are plenty of words. Pick another word. And this word was very hurtful. Quite frankly, to people who deserve to be hurt. Because they were rebelling against Hashem and Moshe's authority. But they deserve to be punished. They don't deserve to be hurt emotionally. So when HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe, you can't go into Eretz Yisrael, stop davening. In Parshas Ve'eschanan, and Moshe davens 500 tefillos, desperately pleading with Hashem to enter Eretz Yisrael. How does Hashem inform Moshe that he's not going into Eretz Yisrael? Also, I didn't write it here. But who knows Parshas Ve'eschanan? Rav Lecha. Enough, Moshe. Al tosef dever layon b'davar hazeh. Don't daven anymore. And in that Rav Lecha, part of the reason Moshe doesn't enter Eretz Yisrael, part of it is because of this moment. Because he wasn't sufficiently sensitive to B'nai Korach. Source number 3, it's a Medrash, it's also Gemara and Sota, we can read the Gemara and Sota, source number 5. Vayom Hashem Elai Rav Lecha. Hashem told Moshe in Parshas Yisrael, Rav Lecha, don't daven anymore. Amar Rabbi Levi, B'Rav Biser, Moshe used the word Rav to lessen B'nai Korach, B'Rav Bisru. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu used that same word. B'Rav Biser, Moshe Rabbeinu launched that word at B'nai Korach, Rav Lechem, B'Rav Bisru, Rav Lecha. Truth is, Moshe already went through this course about being sensitive, and he also had a little bit of a misstep. Early in his career, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu sends him to redeem the Jewish people from Mitzrayim, and he's unsure whether they will believe in him, and he's a little bit wary of going, and that may be legitimate to register your uncertainty, but you say it, I'm not sure. Let me give you some good words to say before you say something that could be hurtful to someone. I'm not sure, but maybe, perhaps, it could be, there may be. You may want to think about this. Try it on for size. Kick the tires a little bit. He'll come out and say, you are. Maybe you could work on this. I'm not sure. I've got my own things to work on, but plenty of words to use to soften the blow. This is not the word to use. Definitely you are. You don't want to start your sentence, which is critiquing someone. There is no question in my mind. I am sure as the day I was born. If there's one thing I know, you're... Don't say it that way. I mean, you don't want to say the softening pillow words that I said before. At least don't make it so clear. Don't rub it in someone's face. And what does Moshe tell Hashem? They're not even there. He says, Hein lo yaminu li in Shmos. Hein is a double entendre. It means Hein, they. What else does Hein mean? Sometimes in Torah, Hein means for sure. It's actually, listen to me. So Hashem stores this away. And he says, when Moshe is trying to get into Eretz Yisrael, what does Hashem tell him? Hein, karvu yamecha lamus. Hein. Remember that word you used about the Jewish people? They didn't even hear it. Source number four. Amar Moshe v'nekadosh baruch hu, hein lo yaminu li v'lo yishma l'koli. So first of all, Moshe gets tzaras then, because even for a second on his hand, because he speaks negatively about the Jewish people, and then when he dies, when he's not allowed to get into Eretz Yisrael, these are the two words that Hashem writes in his sentence. Hein, karvu yamecha lamus. Rav Lecha, Al Tosef. Remember the Hain and Shmos? Remember the Rav Lechem and Karach? It wasn't the best choice of words. Choice of words, guys. Choice of words. There are a lot of difficult situations that our community is facing. And there are a lot of situations we don't have easy answers for. Our world isn't perfect. But there's got to be a difference between what you say and how you say it. And sometimes we, meaning from Jews, even Rabbanim sometimes, we lose on the words. Or we could do a much better job on the words. Are we happy that Jews aren't religious or Orthodox? Is there a problem with secular Jews? Of course. But how do you talk about it? And how do you frame it? And what do you see them as? And Can we provide all the, in many cases, legitimate needs of women in religion? No, there are certain clearly defined red lines. But if you're dealing with someone who's very sincere, and you say, look, halacha just doesn't have a solution for this. You talk in a way that's respectful, that's kind, that's compassionate, that's understanding. You don't start calling people names, and you don't start associating, oh, this one's a reformed, and that one's a conservative, and that one's a snake, and that one's a... Even if you feel that their motives aren't pure. Well, sometimes you have to feel for people. It's easy to have pure motives when you're the privileged one. It's easy to work on your motives when you're the one being the chazan, and you're the one having the aliyah. And all you have to do is work on your motives. But when you feel that in the modern world you're given a voice, and in Yiddishkeit it's hard for you to find that voice, even if it turns into motives that aren't that great in style, okay, so give that person, it's called generosity. Be generous. Understand that people go through difficult situations. Factor it in. People go through hard times. Believe me, I'm the most conservative person. Nothing I'm saying with it. Halacha doesn't provide solutions for any of these. At a human level, speak to people kindly. Speak to people compassionately. Show your human side. Show how much it pains you. I wish there were a solution, but there isn't. And the biggie, and I'm only saying this because if we don't get this right, it's hard to get it right. It's going to tear our communities apart. Homosexuality. How do you talk to people? What words do you use? Chalila b'chas, the people who are going through so much as it is. And we don't have answers. Halacha has very, very few answers. Remember, the hardest part of my life as a rabbi was like 20 years ago, before people were speaking about it publicly. More, I think. 20 years ago, maybe a little less. I was speaking somewhere and someone came over to me and said, Rabbi, I like your speeches, I like your tone, can I speak with you a little bit? He pulled me over to the side. My first encounter was a much more naive period. He says, Rabbi, I'm homosexual. We had long conversations. I didn't sleep for a week out of sadness, knowing what this person would be going through. All the halachic complications he'd have to face, and he'd never be able to have children in the classic fashion. And then one of his questions to me was, can you give me a halachic roadmap? Can you tell me what's more usser, what's less usser? He wanted to know what in his mind he couldn't tell. I said, I can't. You're asking me an impossible question. I can't tell you. It's usser. Do your best. It tore my heart out. But I think he saw the humanity in my eyes, the sadness in my eyes. Not patronizing, understanding it would be very hard for him. Very hard for him. And there is no wiggle room, there's no margin for error. These are people who are facing, in our day, incredibly difficult lives as Orthodox Jews. Incredibly difficult. You all know the heterosexuals, the urges you're feeling right now sexually. You know, sometimes those urges come out, and it's an important struggle, and you should keep struggling with it. But in Eretz Hashem, there's hope on the horizon. At a certain point, you're going to get married, and all these sexual struggles that you're going through, they're just a casualty of the modern world. You know when you would have been sexually active 100 years ago? When you're 13. When you're sexually, physically active, you'd have the chance to be halachically sexual. Most people got married when they're 13. Or 14. So there's no window in which you had sexual, physical needs, and they weren't expressible. And even if you waited, you lived in a world that wasn't sexually overcharged the way our world is. So you weren't being stimulated day and night with sexual stimulus and sexual arousal and facing the struggle you're all facing. But whatever you're going through, the good news is in 3-4 years, it's all going to go away. You're not going to have to face the struggle unless chas v'shalom. If you are in this stage, it won't go away. So just be careful. If you're addicted, marriage isn't going to solve it. Don't think, oh, I'm addicted, I'm fine, I got marriage coming about. If you have a pornography addiction, you have to deal with it as soon as possible in the proper channels, proper ways, because that will not be solved by marriage. I have a stack of letters in my mind that I've heard, that I've read, that people who were in Kollel, the best guy in Kollel, 3-4 kids and 5 hours a night stuck on the internet. So don't delude yourself. That's like an addiction, there's something called an urge and you're struggling with it and you're trying to manage it, then there's something called addiction. Addiction means you don't have control over your time, you don't have control over your decisions. If you have that, you are headed for a terrible, terrible life. And don't think that a vacuum cleaner called marriage is just going to all wipe it away. It's not. And you have to deal with it like any addiction. And the good news is, with hard work, you can really come out on the other end. So just know, call it addiction. It's not an urge. It's called an addiction. It's like drugs, it's like whiskey, it's like smoking, it's like any other addiction. But now you're facing a world in which you can't ever express it halachically. Wow. That's really hard. The least you can do is say a kind word to that person, or be kind to that person, and open up your house for Shabbos with, let's say, other people that want to have that person at their Shabbos table, chas v'shalom. And chas v'shalom, never say anything that will just, how can I say pour salt into a wound? It's like, I don't know, pouring acid into a wound. I mean, the wounds are so hard to deal with, and it's so burning and stinging. There is no solution. There is no solution. I'll say it as clearly as I can for you. Theologically, there's no solution. There are two poles, each of which is irrefutable. And if you dare challenge any of those two poles, I think you're turning your back on fundamental values, and they contradict. One pole is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's word is eternally true. Eternally true. And when HaKadosh Baruch Hu said that homosexual activity is usher, it is usher. And when Hashem says it's a to'eva, it is a to'eva. There is no wiggle room. Hashem said it, and His word holds eternal truth. There's no qualification or conditioning. On the other pole, 3% more or less, or whatever percentage of today's world, seems to have, at least the way science has proven today, homosexual inclinations or predilections. And they are normal people like you or me. They're not sexual fiends. They're not monsters. They're normal people. And questioning their normalcy or their mental health is an insult to them and an insult to yourself. Because they're normal people like you and me. Now here's the question. How could HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who said one thing, have created them that way? You know what? I don't have an answer to that question. And no one has an answer to that question. And sometimes you just have to live with questions and take those questions to your grave, rather than saying simplistic things that will either be heretical or not just insulting but dishonest. Because to say that homosexual people are miscreants, it's simply dishonest and repugnant. And Hashem created them that way, at least the way 2021 science teaches. Maybe in 200 years we'll have a different set of scientific skills. But right now we have to rely on the scientific world as we see it. So just stop it. Is the Holocaust a seven anti? I'm not custom dependent in terms of just there are questions you carry. We're not going to solve everything. The only thing you can do is learn how to speak. And learn how to treat people. And especially people who have a hard time. I took it to an extreme. You all know the guy in MTA. I don't know the guy nowhere, hardly know you. Who had a harder time than you growing up. Whose father passed away, you know, when he was 15. Who suffered a tragedy. I don't know, who was more nerdy than you and didn't have as many friends, whatever. Show that person a little kindness. It won't kill you. It won't kill you to be a little generous with your spirit and to be a little bit more open. And know when you're in high school, the insecurities of high school make you want to hang out with the right people and be seen with the right people, the cool people, and God forbid I should talk to that person over there. What's he going to do to my reputation? Welcome to the real world now. Now it's about real relationships. The least you could do is show that person some kindness. Be a little kind to that person instead of being so selfish. Not all about you. So you have to really, really work in today's world. I'll tell you the place not to work on it. The place not to work on is social media. Social media is a lot of violent speech. Because you're going to get people's attention. If I put it on my social media page, perhaps you might be interested in this Dvar Torah that may be helpful to you today. That could be constructive in helping you understand something that may... No, it's going to work. Here's the shear of the year. You don't see this shear. Blaring things. Come to my share. See this shear. Nice picture. You don't stand a chance in social media if you're talking qualifications and subtleties. Blaring. This is it. Neon lights. Loud horns. Come on. Come to me. And violence. Violence attracts attention. Come on. A good fisticuff. A good fight. Now it's time to, you know what? Let's get into it. I was Shabbos with the Shir Dalit boys, and they started to have workshops on how to communicate. So they divided themselves into groups and rotating groups, and they just debated topics. And they're like such pansies. Like, come on, start fighting each other. Finally, they started getting into each other. It was all joking and stuff. Come on, get into each other. Start latching into each other. Wants to see two pansies, two daffodils, talk about the summer breeze and the winter frost. Give me something to enjoy. We're all good voyeurs. We want to see blood. We want to see anger. We want to see gossip. We want to see divorce. We want to see extramarital affair. Come on. We don't want to be bored. We want to see people's lives and how it falls apart. We want to see the cracks in people's armor. We don't want to just see good things. So you go down that way, you'll talk very violently and gossipy and subversively. So you're not going to find this in many Musar Svarim, but you'll find it in this room. And you'll find it in Chazal. Work on language. Work as hard as you can on language. Choose your words carefully. You know the best word to use if you're in doubt? It's obvious. I'll say it, but you have to listen really carefully. Here's the best word to use if you're in doubt. I just said it. It's called silence. Just don't say anything. Don't say anything. You know the second best word to use? This is a great one. I wish more politicians knew it. When they're like looking at you and they want a response, you have to look at me because it's another word you're not going to hear if you don't look at me. Just smile. Everyone likes a good smile. Don't smile patronizing. Like laugh. Not in a patronizing way. So many of these politicians just don't get it right. A says something to B and B has to retaliate. Makes sense. Just laugh. Move on. I promise you, you know how to be silent, you know how to smile, you're way ahead of the curve. You're way ahead of the curve. Doesn't always have to be furrowed brows and screaming and shouting. Come on, just bring it down a little bit. Stop the screaming. I don't need shouters in my life. You know, just talk normal to me. So Moshe, again, I'm being a demagogue, I'm exaggerating. Moshe didn't do any of this. He wasn't shouting, wasn't violent communication. You know, Moshe was the nicest guy on the planet, obviously. He was an Ish Elokim. But at his level, these words were just ill-chosen. One of the best words to choose because of those words, Moshe Rabbeinu, is punished. Doesn't get to the Eretz Yisrael. Or at least his sentence is handed down with those words. Okay, we have 5 minutes. Very, very pedantic about not giving you guys extra time to relax. That's one of my joys as a Rebbe, not seeing you guys enjoy yourself. So I take 4 minutes to describe one little topic. It's a larger topic. If you want to really feel like it, it'll be published in some of the newspapers this week. I called it Korach, Democracy, and the Scrubbing of Identity. Okay, so maybe I'll just talk about it in general, then I'll show you where it is in Korach. Democracy is the rock star of the modern age, for sure. It has relieve people from thousands of years of suppression and persecution. You say the word democracy, everything else stops. It should, obviously, I'm saying it sarcastically. Democracy is a value. It's the highest form of government we've been able, most fair and equitable. We should be supporters of democracy, but for a Jew to say it's the highest value, or it's the only value, the greatest corruptions in life is when full value, an absolute value, is assigned to a partial value. Corruptions don't happen when terrible values masquerade as good values. Most sane people can see through it. Corruptions occur when values are given disproportionate weight. It's all about calculus. You're good in calculus, you're good in life. You're able to, it's called kal vachomer, calculus. What's more, what's less? What should be given more, what should be given less? Like I sometimes laugh when I hear this conversation in Israel. How can we be a Jewish state and a democratic state, which is really a demographic problem, because if we incorporate all the Arabs, either all the Arab citizens or the Palestinians, how do we ask? And it never like dawns, I'm not saying we should do this, but it never dawns on people to say maybe it should be a democracy. Like maybe we shouldn't, maybe the mandate of having a Jewish state is so important historically that at this point we just don't have the ability to both have a Jewish state, which is a historical prophetic outcome, and a democracy. I mean, if you say that, I'm not saying you say that to non-Jews, you say that to 95% of the Jews in the world. Conversation ends. How dare you? What is? I'm a pretty fair guy. Now, again, I would not want a state that's discriminatory. I don't know. I have to build a state that is not a democracy that protects everyone's rights. I don't know the answer to that. But I'm at least willing to use the terminology. I'm at least willing to say that democracy is not a sacred cow. It's an important value. How can we serve it? I don't have a better solution. I'm not saying I'm such a wise man. But I'm wise enough to know that terminology can be entrapping. So, support democracy, advance democracy, relish democracy, protect democracy, but also be aware of how democracy has become more than a political and economic liberator, which it is, capitalism, democracy, become a culture of democracy, and the culture of democracy has created a lot of dangers. One of them is moral relativism. If everyone has equal voting capacity, they have equal moral view capacity. Everyone's equal in the ballot box. Everyone's equal in the moral conversation. And that's not true. There's certain moral red lines that shouldn't be justified. It's not like every position has to be understood. Many, many, many dangers of democracy. One of them, which I'll talk about in 30 seconds, the Korach syndrome, is called identity scrubbing. You know it as PC. There are ethnic differences. There are racial differences. There are religious differences. There are gender differences. Those are part of identity. My identity is a Jew, who is a male, who whatever comes from this ethnicity, and that's my identity. Now, when these identity markers become discriminatory, that's when democracy has to step in and say, no, 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 no. This ethnicity is the same as that ethnicity, and this gender deserves the same rights as that gender, and this religion deserves, that's what democracy is heroic. Not allowing identity markers to become unfair, biased, or chas v'shalom bigoted. But when the culture of democracy, not political democracy, starts to scrub or erase these and becomes inappropriate to say someone's ethnicity or to believe or affirm your ethnicity or to say someone's gender, he or she, or to affirm, then identity dissolves and communities vanish because communities are built around shared values. You can't build a community unless you have something in common. That's the war we're fighting. That's the battle in today's democratic world. To reaffirm identity markers, that Hashem creates divisions in our world, but Chas Hashem not to allow them. And the world is so traumatized by the discriminatory expressions of identity, especially in the 20th century, Nazism and fascism, And every corruption, another good phrase, every corruption, more corruptions happen in the backwash and the reaction to extremes when the pendulum is swinging wildly from side to side. That's where you've got really bad corruptions. And modern world is trying to find it. That's Korach's mistake. Korach says, everyone's holy. If everyone's holy, then everyone should be a Kohen. Stop. Everyone's holy, yes. But there's specialization. And there's specialization, Kohanim and Leviim. And there's nothing discriminatory about that. And that's why Moshe says the word Bokeh, V'yod es Hashem es Shiloh. There are built-in differences in our world without which the world would collapse. There needs to be day, and there needs to be night. Without daytime, human productivity would halt. Without nighttime, human energy would deplete. There's nothing discriminatory about day and night. It's just differences. And just like there are differences in the natural order, there are differences in the religious order. Just like there are boundaries in the religious order, there are boundaries in the personal order. That's what Hashem, that's what Moshe tells Korach. This is the last line. Look at the source here. Bottom of page 1. Amar le Moshe, givulos chalak HaKadosh Baruch Hu be'olamo. There are boundaries. Yecholim atem la'ariv yom v'layla. Can you turn daytime into nighttime? No, you need daytime, you need nighttime. You need a Kohen, you need a lady, you need a man, you need a woman. You need this race and that race. And that's the elusive struggle of the human experience, to have divisions and boundaries and identities and communities, but have them be all equal. And democracy is starting, the culture of politically correct and the inability to say anything that suggests differences is scrubbing our identity. And when identity gets scrubbed, it gets deleted. And it's like people are living without identity. It's a hard way to live your life. Okay, a lot to think about tonight. Demagogues, cynics, kind words, nonviolent communication, and don't scrub your identity. Kind words is the most important thing, obviously. Okay, Laila Tova. And don't mention my name on your demagogue resume. I'll deny it. Plausible deniability. I never taught him. I'll become a demagogue. You think I taught him? I taught you!
Line between cynicism and
naivety. No.
What part?
It's better to be a little naive than not to be cynical. Namely, your question. Let me say the